Good morning and welcome to another edition of Weekend Magazine. This is Marietta Allen, and we have a very special guest today. We're going to be speaking with Dennis Wepman, who's the director of the Carpolis Manuscript Library Museum. They have a really great exhibit that's going to be running from June to August. Hello, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. Maybe, first of all, tell everybody, where is the Carpolis?
It is in Newburgh on the corner of Broadway and Liberty Street, which is a couple of blocks from the river, and in the very heart of town across from City Hall. And it is the former Newburgh Savings Bank, which is a famous institution for many years
beautiful,
in the city.
Beautiful building.
And a beautiful and stately building, right.
And you've been there for how long?
I've been here since about 2004 as a regular full-time employee.
And the museum's been around, maybe since 2000 or so? Is it around?
Well, the building was a bank, the Newburgh Savings Bank, and then it changed hands a couple of times until the year 2000 when it opened as a museum.
Okay,
right?
So 2000 you opened as your museum. Good, right. good. And you, what kind of things, what kind of exhibits do you tend to do, and what's the whole philosophy behind it?
Well, the museum is one of a chain of now 14 buildings around the country that display selections from the private collection of David Carpolis. David Carpolis is a leading collector of autograph and manuscript material of a complete range of subjects, from ancient hieroglyphics through medieval illuminated manuscripts and documents from governments and celebrities in all fields. He has music manuscripts by classic composers and papal signed documents of things that are literary, things that are in the arts, things that are in sports, and also some artifacts related to those things. And from his huge collection, which is said to include more than 1 million individual pieces and is said to be the largest in private hands in the world, he makes selections thematically on an infinite range of subjects and sends them to a museum, to one of the museums, which then sends it to another, and they rotate through the entire 14.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to tell you, the best exhibit, which will also give people the an idea of the caliber of these documents. There was one that he did, and I think it was like the 50 most important documents or something. And it had the Magna Carta was there. It had the Emancipation Proclamation. There was a page from the Gutenberg Bible, the original Bible. It's just amazing stuff that he's got in that collection. And I had him on the air. We did an interview with him, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I said, how did you get started? And I guess he was looking for things for his kids to be interested in. And one day, they were somewhere, and the kids were really, they were fascinated by the signature of, I forgot what the document was, he told me. And then so that started the whole thing, and then he started collecting, and then it got bigger and bigger, and multiple locations. And they rotate these collections, right? They rotate them around.
Well, the selections that he makes from his larger collection is then sent from one museum to the next until it has finished the entire circuit. In the meantime, he is creating a new one every month.
Yep. So you got one in Buffalo, you got one here. I think Florida, there was a location.
We have actually two in Buffalo.
Two in Buffalo.
There is one in Florida, and there are others all over the country, certainly.
Yep.
Based really on where he finds an impressive building, not necessarily on the historic importance of the city. He's based and lives in Santa Barbara, California.
Okay.
And he has one in Montecito, California, for instance. But he has a major one in Duluth, where he had spent some of his youth. There's one in Jacksonville, Florida. Uh-huh. One in Charleston, South Carolina. A major one in Tacoma, Washington. And elsewhere, some in Texas, as a matter of fact. Whenever he finds a great building, he just adds it to the collection.
It's so nice. It's really great. And he's a realtor, too. He had a real estate background, I think, right? He was a
I'm not sure exactly what he did. I don't think he was a realtor. He was a developer, a real estate developer.
Yeah,
I guess still is.
So he appreciates good properties. That's a good thing.
he appreciates impressive buildings which are no longer financially usable.
Yeah.
Most of the great buildings in his large collection were churches.
Oh, okay.
And when a church can't support a building anymore, it's hard to sell it because it's hard to put such a building with the architecture of churches to a commercial use.
Mm-hmm.
You can't conveniently turn it into a restaurant or a residential property. And so frequently they are sold to institutions like his for cultural purposes where they are nonprofit organizations and are not a commercial property.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
That gives him the advantage of its being tax-free.
Yep.
But he's confronted, of course, with all the expenses of its maintenance as well as the expenses of the museum.
Yep. And they're beautiful structures, too. Beautifully made, everything. I mean, and that bank that your location is, boy, that's a solid, beautiful building.
Yeah, it's a very impressive building.
Oh, yeah.
Put up in 1923.
Yeah.
And in the museum, there are a few cases with some memorabilia of the bank, which goes back well before 1923. The bank goes back to the 1850s
uh-huh.
in previous buildings, and some of them are photographed and described in the museum as a subordinate element of the exhibit.
Well, now let's talk about this new exhibit coming in, and you know, our listeners are going to be able to see the breadth of the kinds of interesting documents you're going to have. What's it called, and when is it running, and what do you have going on?
It isn't the first time, although it is somewhat different from an earlier exhibit at the museum and at all of the museums on the subject, which is the history of medicine. And by medicine, that's meant both the medications and the treatment, the use of medicine. There was a show with a very similar selection, slightly varied from the present one, in 2000, I'm not sure exactly when, but 8 or 10 years ago, I guess,
mm-hmm.
before I was connected with this museum. And the present one, which will run through the end of August, they run for 4 months ordinarily, covers the same general field, a very wide range of things that are interesting to look at and are historically important in a variety of fields. It goes back, I think the earliest piece is a handwritten page by William Harvey, who is considered the man who instituted and established in the medical field the fact of the circulation of blood.
Oh, yeah. That was an important book. Everybody used that.
It was a controversial book and a revolutionary book. There was a different understanding of the anatomical process of blood in the body. And that goes back to 1620. The book was published in 1628. And there are other early things. There's a contract for treatment signed by Anton Mesmer, who is the man who introduced the idea of hypnotism as we now know it. Then, because he introduced it, it was known as mesmerism, which is still used sometimes, as a treatment for physical problems. That's been sort of dismissed, but it's certainly a major part of both psychological and medical history.
Was that contract it described what Mesmer was going to be doing to the
no,
person?
No, not in great detail, but it is an actual signature of the man signed in 1775.
Wow, isn't that something?
But most of the stuff is more contemporary medicine, which includes all ranges of medicine, mostly 19th and early 20th century, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So now you've got some of the big guys, I think Christian Bernard, right?
Bernard. It's usually pronounced, yeah. Yeah, that's a particularly interesting thing. Christian Bernard was the South African surgeon who performed the first successful and, I guess, the first functional human heart transplant. And he wrote his memoirs, a page of which, signed by him, is included in this, describing the procedure, which had never been successfully done before.
Wow.
There's also, earlier than that, though, a letter, as I mentioned, written in 1901 by Joseph Lister, a man whose name is now known because it was given to the commercial product Listerine, who was essentially the innovator of the concept of real antiseptic practice in surgery.
I didn't know that. So Listerine was named after Lister, and Lister was into the antiseptic idea.
Right. He was Joseph Lister is kind of the creator of the idea of antiseptic procedures in hospitals.
Uh-huh. How did he figure that out? Do you know? Did he?
Well, he didn't fully grasp, as we could hardly expect him to have done, the dangers of infection in hospitals, but he recognized that hospitals that were kept clean had less post-surgical infection than those that weren't.
Isn't that interesting? Boy, that's, you know, I read something, too, that in the 50s, I guess all the hospitals were required to wash everything down with, like, Clorox bleach, you know, bleach everything. And then after, when it got into the 60s and 70s, then they started changing it and they used other kinds of things. And now we got MRSA and all these diseases from it. I'm wondering if you go back to good old, you know, bleach everything, you might end up with less of these bugs floating around, you know?
Well, we are still at the threshold of understanding the nature of these interactions, and this exhibit covers a very wide range of examples of the progress and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actual medical treatment, but there's also a good deal of stuff on nutrition, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It's got material from the discoverers of the concept of vitamins, which is something that wasn't actually recognized as a chemical phenomenon until almost our time.
Mm-hmm. Well, they up until after World War II, then it became, you know, they had the outgrowth of the oil industry and stuff where they were starting to use drugs. But before that, they were curing everything with you know, it was all nutritional therapy, pretty much. That's what they did. So that was, what did you have from there? Who was the, what kind of documents were you having that had to do with nutrition?
Well, there were signed material from the developers of documents. I don't recall right off the top of my head exactly all the names, but
there was somebody, Pavi, you had, right? It had to do with diabetes or something?
Well, he was the man who discovered the nature of diabetes, which was much more of a plague. And there was a letter from him on the subject from 1907.
Mm-hmm.
Also, some of the great plagues in history are described. There's a very interesting letter from Albert Schweitzer, who is a legendary humanitarian doctor who worked in Africa on leprosy. And there's a letter from him in 1903 in which he talks about one of the drugs that was just being developed. And the cholera plague was described by President Theodore Roosevelt, and he signed a document to the Congress in 1904 urging the support of an international convention in Paris at the time on that subject. And interestingly, not only the physical conditions, but mental problems are included. There's a document signed by Dorothy Dix, the philanthropic public reformer, on the rights of inmates in mental institutions, in prisons, and in what were then known as lunatic asylums.
Wow, that's interesting.
Which are described in very humanitarian terms.
Uh-huh. And
also the development of antibiotics. And there's a particularly interesting thing, as I mentioned, I think, to the newspapers. There is a letter from one of the co-winners of the Nobel Prize in 1945 for the discovery of penicillin. And it's an interesting letter, but it includes an actual sample of the original mold produced in the laboratory of that man and Alexander Fleming, whose name is best known as the developer of penicillin. In 1945 for the Nobel Prize. So there's a sample of the actual selection that was produced in that laboratory. So, as I say, it covers a complete range of medical approaches to things. A lot of stuff on vitamins, and signed by Casimir Funk, for instance, who is considered, he's the man anyway, if he didn't actually discover the concept, he's the man who named them vitamins. Mm. He discovered that certain amino acids were vital to the human body's function, and so he called them vital amines, which he condensed to vitamines.
What was his name again? What was the name?
His last name is Funk, F-U-N-K.
F-U-N-K. I got to look him up.
Oh. Yeah, Casimir Funk.
So anybody that's really interested in these topics, when you see the documents, you can actually go back and look up the material from them. And I know Schweitzer's wife, I wish I could remember the guy who cured her of, there was a terrible disease, and it was something that was a vitamin deficiency, actually. And the guy gave her the vitamin, and she was cured. And there was, Schweitzer wrote to him and was so grateful to him and everything. But there's a lot of interesting things if you want to look up some of the history, too.
One of the features of the museum, which should certainly be mentioned, is each of these documents, some of them are in other languages, and some of them are very hard handwriting to read. So all the information about this material is not necessarily collectible from the documents themselves. It's exciting to see the actual signature in the hand of a famous person. But they're all described at some length in printed material that's put in plastic cases above the exhibit. So every exhibit is accompanied by a long explanation of it and a transcription of it. And when they are in other languages, frequently a translation of it. So you get a little essay on what Funk did and how he created the concept. So it's not only exciting to see the firsthand material, but it's educational to learn the whole history of it. And every one of them has, some of them short, but some of them fairly long paragraphs of essays.
Yeah, very, very good. How many documents do you have for this particular exhibit? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I think 25.
Wow.
Usually they're 25 to 30, but of course some are very long and some are just brief little notes.
Yeah.
But they cover, as I say, a really wide range of material. It covers, for instance, there's a letter from the father of the Mayo brothers, who was himself a very famous doctor. So there's a discussion of the Mayo Clinic. William Mayo was a co-founder with his two sons, the Mayo brothers. It discusses the founding of the famous Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And it, you know, discovers a wide range of material on all aspects. Edward Jenner is included in the development and the need to promote vaccination going, you know, way back in time, still a somewhat controversial issue. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking now, a necessary element for the correction, prevention of epidemics.
Does it tell what he put in the original vaccines? I would be so curious. I mean, did he put mercury in it back then? I don't know.
Well, when I don't think mercury. I don't know that it doesn't say that. I'm not sure the details.
That's interesting to see that kind of. Are you finding doctors are going to be interested in coming to this? Are you?
Well, so far I haven't seen any evidence of that, but I'm sure the medical establishment in the area will know about this and will make an effort of it.
Yeah. What are some of the other ones you were telling me?
Well, there's some really exotic things. If you remember the movie The Elephant Man, that man was a victim of a terrible disease which produced terrible disfigurement, and the doctor who took him in was a well-known English doctor whose name was William Harvey, and he has a letter describing his treatment of this unfortunate figure. And next to it is a picture of the Elephant Man, who is known from the movie and from the famous Broadway play, but the makeup didn't quite capture the particular dreadful disfigurement of his face. So this photograph kind of illustrates the condition of this guy.
And Harvey was the guy that did the circulation.
No, I'm sorry. It wasn't Harvey did that.
It was a different guy.
Yeah.
All right. Wow, that's interesting. So you've got some really nice, you got photographs too involved.
His name was Merrick, Joseph Merrick.
Okay.
And it's an account by him of the victim of this disease. I'm sorry, the doctor was Frederick Treves, T-R-E-V-E-S.
Okay. Wow. So those are really interesting things for people to see.
Yeah, Joseph Lister is represented, as I say, who is a pioneer of antiseptic practice. So there's a wide variety. The polio epidemic and its treatments is described at some length here. A paper was presented on the control of the epidemic from 1983. So almost any aspect of medical progress and medicine, nutrition, surgery is covered in first-hand documents.
Okay. What is the newest of all the documents that are there, would you say, time-wise? Does it go into the 90s, or is it mostly... the heart, 1967 would be the heart transplant, so that's fairly new.
That's fairly new, yeah. That may be the latest one.
Yeah.
More of it is like the cholera plague in 1903, mm-hmm. and the development of vitamins and so forth. I don't know. DNA in 1977, the development and discovery and isolation of DNA is covered by a document.
So that's who? That's Crick and Watson, or was that the... Wow, that's a biggie.
Yeah, well, almost any major breakthrough in... that was Francis Crick.
Oh, Crick, yep.
Yeah, is touched on, and there is some document in the hand of the person who was the essential developer of it or the promoter of it. And as usual, we are now open every day. I don't know if I mentioned that fact.
No, we should do the hours and all that information.
Yeah, the museum is on that corner, on the... northeast corner of Broadway and Liberty Street.
Okay.
And it's open every day from 10 until 4, except on Sunday when it's open from 12 to 4.
Okay. And if somebody wanted to bring a bus of people, because we're throughout the Hudson Valley, you might get a bus group coming. Should they call ahead?
Well, they usually do, but there's no need to, really.
Okay.
The room is very big, and the only need for actual planning in advance, if a large crowd is going to have a meeting or something here and sort of take it over, and we are open to those suggestions for gatherings, but school groups come in all the time.
Okay.
And it holds comfortably as many as 50 people at one time, so there's seldom any need for prior planning.
Okay. Now, what is your web? Let's get your website so people can look at the exhibits. You know, when they every quarter they can go on and see what's new, and we'll get a phone number maybe if they have a question.
Well, the phone number 845-569-4997. The official address is 94 Broadway. And we have a general website which gives all of the museums of the 14 with little summaries, and you can click on each one. And that is the obvious website of www.carpeles, that's K-A-R-P for Paul, E-L-E-S, .com, www.carpeles.com.
Well, if something's in the Buffalo Museum, can we assume it'll eventually be in Newburgh, or do we have to travel? Are each one independent?
Well, you don't have to travel because none of them lasts more than 3 or 4 months where they are. They're not independent. They are in constant circulation.
So they will get to Newburgh eventually then if it doesn't
necessarily follow. They may already have been in Newburgh.
Right.
And new exhibits are emerging all the time. Even when the title is the same, there's frequently some changes. As the collection of David Karpeles, who is now over 80 years old, continues to be a very vital phenomenon, and he is constantly increasing his collection. So the exhibit on medicine, early history of medicine, that we are now showing contains some things that weren't in the one that we showed 10, 12 years ago.
All right, that's good to know. Well, listen, we're running out of, we're out of time, Dennis. So what we'll do is hope everybody can come to see you. They can check your website also for, you know, what's coming every quarter.
Yeah, if you go to the general website and click on the Newburgh one, you'll see the up-to-date current thing. Okay. Admission is always free.
Okay. And thank you very, very much. And this will be aired on all of our channels, and then it's going to be archived, realcountryhv.com, and people can listen to it again if you're driving when you hear the show or whatever, so everybody can check it out. All right, so have a wonderful week. Thank you very much, Dennis, and I hope everybody that's listening has a good time at the Carpleys.
Thank you very much. You will all be welcome.
All right. Well, that's a wrap for this week. I hope you take advantage of the opportunities that are abounding in the Hudson Valley. Take care. Bye-bye.